Hi, my name is Don Hahn. I'm the producer of Lion King and Beauty and the Beast, and you're listening to the Pixar Podcast.
To infinity and beyond!
So, how long is this going to take?
Squirrel!
You can't rush Arch.
I never look back, darling. It distracts from the now.
What's the point of going out there? They'll only laugh at me.
Stranger, from the outside.
Greetings.
Hello, everybody. Welcome again to another episode of the Pixar Podcast. This is episode 110. ThePixarPodcast.com/110 is where you can find the show notes for this episode. I'm Derek Clements. And it's very great to be back, everybody. It's been over a year since the last podcast episode. And to be honest, I kind of expected to be done. And just kind of, you know, let the interviews that I did over the years sit in an archive. Students and fans collecting digital dust. But a few months ago, I realized how much I missed making this podcast. And I thought, 2015, it's going to be such an exciting year for Pixar. Not only is it going to be the 20th anniversary of Toy Story, the very first computer animated feature film, but Pixar also has two feature films coming out this year. And both of those films have been very, very high on my excitement radar. Inside Out and The Good Dinosaur, both coming out this year. So with all that, I thought, it's time. It's time to do some new episodes of the podcast. So a big hello from me to you, and I'm very excited to be with all of you again. If you're new to the podcast, I encourage you to check out thepixarpodcast.com. There are over 100 episodes of interviews and news episodes and all kinds of stuff to bring you behind the scenes of Pixar Animation Studios. And I'm very excited that over the next several weeks, I'm going to be bringing you behind the scenes of Inside Out, Pixar's next film. I recorded a bunch of material recently, actually last week, inside Pixar. I got to go back and talk to many of the filmmakers that were responsible for making Inside Out. It was very, very delightful to meet all those people. And I'm very pleased to kick off this new season of the podcast today with acclaimed Pixar filmmakers Pete Docter and producer Jonas Rivera. I spoke to them both last week in Pixar, and I think that you will really enjoy hearing what they have to say. This is not the first time that Pete Docter and Jonas Rivera have worked together on a Pixar film. They last partnered up for Up, which, by the way, was nominated for Best Picture, the Academy Awards. Pete Docter, of course, also directed Monsters, Inc., and was one of the first employees ever at Pixar. Actually, so was Jonas Rivera. He was the studio's first intern, so it was fun to talk to him about that. It was just a huge honor to meet both of these gentlemen. I sat down one-on-one with Jonas Rivera, and you're going to hear that in a minute. And I also joined a roundtable interview with Jonas Rivera and Pete Docter. So today's episode of the Pixar Podcast is going to feature both of those interviews. But first, I want to tell you about what I saw from Inside Out.
Joy. This is sadness. That's anger.
What?
This is disgust. And that's fear.
Ah!
We're Riley's emotions. These are Riley's memories. They're mostly happy, you'll notice, not to brag.
I wanted to maybe hold one.
What happened? Sadness?
She did something to the memory.
Is everything okay?
I don't know.
Can't get back, Joy.
I'm trying.
Joy, no.
Let's
wait.
Go.
The core memories.
Ah! No. Ah!
Can I say that curse word now?
That was from the trailer for Inside Out. You may have heard Amy Poehler's voice, among other great talented voice actors in that film. At the event at Pixar last week, they showed us the first hour of the film. And judging from that first hour, it is going to be incredible. The first hour that I saw had some of the best animation footage that I've seen in a Pixar film. The story and the animation and the ideas are all truly firing on all cylinders. It's right up there for me with The Incredibles, Ratatouille, Up, Monsters, Inc. It's extremely inventive. And this is – we see this in you know, all of Pete Docter's films and all of the best Pixar films. Just extremely interesting and inventive and creative things going on screen. But like the best Pixar, on top of those things, on top of all that – creativity and silliness sometimes and pure originality. It's also just got a very pure, simple, emotional core that I think really, really is going to resonate with audiences. It certainly did with me. I can't wait to see the rest of the film. It comes out in the United States on June 19th, and I will be there in theaters with my tissue in hand. It's going to be a great film, folks. And without further ado, let's go ahead and dive into these recordings of the filmmakers, starting with my one-on-one interview. Here it is with Jonas Rivera, producer of Inside Out.
Okay. So, here's what I'm curious about.
Yes, sir.
How many times in your life have you woken up in the morning and said, I have been nominated for Best Picture?
How many times? Oh, boy. That is, I'll be honest with you, yeah. A few times, because that's something that I never dreamed in my wildest dreams would happen. Yeah. And it actually didn't really dawn on me until we sat down that night. Because, yeah. It's the only time in my life, in my career, that I've ever had a better seat than John Lasseter. It's the only time I ever looked back and waved, you know, because of the nomination.
Yeah.
My wife and I were only in the fourth row or something crazy, you know, yeah. And it was just unbelievable. It's just something I'm really proud of.
Yeah. Well, any great stories from that night?
That night, I mean, the whole run up to that was just surreal, and everyone, the other nominees were so kind, and we got to know them all. It was funny because it was Up in the Air was also right. Nominated because of the name. We were always sort of with those guys, you know, and we just kind of became buddies, and we just had a great night. What was the, here's a funny story about that night. It was sort of a Mike Wazowski moment, because okay. I told my family, who was obviously very excited, that listen, at worst. This is not we knew we wouldn't win Best Picture,
right?
But I said, you know, my grandmother and my family, like, at worst, you know, it's going to be, and the nominees are, and they're going to kind of flash to everybody, and you'll get to see, Grandma, watch, you'll see me, this and that. And so that was coming up, and we're getting excited. And Tom Hanks walks out onto the stage, and he says, well, we're out of time, so we're going to cut right to the final award. And the winner of that, so they didn't do it. So we're like,
oh,
I told them to watch that moment, and instead they had to cut right to it.
That is a Mike Wazowski moment.
It was like, I'm on the cover of a magazine.
Yeah. Nice. Well, congratulations on that film as well. But I'm so excited about Inside Out. It just looks so great. I've been asking everybody, who is Pete Docter? And I think I'll ask you about your relationship with him. So you work with him. You seem pretty close with him. When did you realize that you really had a special thing with Pete?
Pete and I guess very early on, when I first came to Pixar and as the intern even,
yeah.
I found that this is a place that's sort of, a lot of people were cut from the same cloth. I'm just a big Disney fan, and I just kind of made myself available and useful in the art department in the early days of finding reference when people needed a piece of animation. I knew that shot, and I could maybe go down to the Disney archives and pull it. And
yeah.
And I shared a common language with the artist that Pete loves. You know, we talked a lot. I remember early on about, like, Mary Blair, for example, okay. that we shared this love for her work. And in fact, we partnered on a book of her early on that we wanted to help make. And so we just did a lot of work together, both side projects and at the studio. And we, you know, talked and about the same animated films that we loved and the same scenes and for the same similar reasons. And so we kind of became bonded over our love of animation and hand-drawn animation, the stuff of the old days. And then Disneyland, which is one of the big passions of my life, and as is Pete. So we would just we'd geek out over the signage of the Tiki Room or whatever it was, and just shared that, and kind of became friends over that stuff. And I worked in the art department on Monsters, Inc. with him. And that kind of evolved into, you know, working on Up Together, which was the thrill of a lifetime.
Yeah.
And I think we just kind of created a relationship of trust when you're making these films, and he's the creative driver, and I'm honored that he sort of trusts my instincts in hand to put enough pressure on those ideas that they'll get done, but not enough that they'll be crushed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, how does that work? Because being a producer, that seems like a creative job as well.
Yeah.
So what is the division of labor creatively for that?
Well, I do feel like I'm a creative producer. I don't sit in the story room and look over his shoulder and review the script pages, and I don't try to pretend that that's my skill. Although I do know a lot about movies and a lot about storytelling, but what I try to do from the creative side is I try to channel the audience. So I'll often say things. I don't know. My comments will be about, I don't know if that's as clear as it could be, or I don't know if my mom were watching the movie, she would understand that, or if that would be gettable. So I try to, because Pete and Ronnie Del Carmen and Josh Cooley, I mean, they're such talented writers and storytellers. And I think if they're, this isn't a flaw or anything, but they get mired in so much the detail that I at least try to do flyovers and like pull them out and remind them it's a motion picture. And I think kind of like that's part of my job.
Yeah. Okay. Great. I want to talk about your internship.
Yeah.
So you were the first Pixar intern. What did you expect on that very first day? And why did you apply?
Yeah. Well, I applied because I saw Luxo Jr. at San Francisco State. I was in the film department there, and it was in one of the animation classes. Yeah. And it was the first thing I ever saw in computer animation that I liked. I wasn't a really big fan of computer animation.
Oh.
When I saw that film.
And what year is this?
This is 94.
Okay.
And I saw that film. I loved it. I wanted to learn more about it, and I knew Pixar was local. So I literally called them. I kind of cold called the production office and said, "Listen, I'm a student at San Francisco State. I love animation. I'd love to come and help.
Yeah.
Do you have any internships?" They said, "Well, not really, but we need help." So I went down and I interviewed, and the interview was really an hour and a half of them trying to talk me out of it because it was not going to be glamorous. You're not going to meet Steve Jobs. Yeah. You know, I said, "Well, I don't care.
We're in the old Richmond building."
And it was November of '94, and so I came on. I think literally the first day. I think I built desks. I think I had to go to like Office Depot and buy desks and build them, and because we were hiring a bunch of animators at the time to get Toy Story done. But I was literally, you know, I'm proud I was there for that final year of Toy Story. I kind of saw it come together, and you know.
But you didn't like computer animation. That's interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know a lot about it, but I was more, you know, sort of old school. I was a fan of hand drawn, and I still am, of course.
Sure.
But I saw a lot of the stuff that was out there just didn't feel like it was character driven. It was probably slick and it was well done, but it didn't have any tug of the heart or emotion to me.
Sure.
But Luxo Jr., you know, and you look at it now, and I think it's aged very well. It's character animation.
Sure.
It's like an old Pluto short or something, you know.
Right.
And I saw that and thought, that's where I want to be. And I had no idea.
Sure.
It was just luck when I got here that they were actually making a Disney movie that sort of had its roots in classic Disney animation another foot in sort of Lucasfilm Star Wars, you know. So that's my childhood, as I'm sure a lot of us. So I felt like I had just landed in the perfect spot. And I remember seeing the first scene, the Army Man scene, you know, on film, like on my third day, and calling my parents and going, "Oh my, like they're never going to get me out of here. This is I'm in the right spot."
Cool.
You know, so
great. Okay, final question. In the film, memories are represented by little balls, and core memories are very important. What's a core memory of making the film that you can recall?
Oh wow, great question. There's a lot of great memories of making the film, but I feel like the first time Pete pitched it. And I had no visuals, and there was none of this artwork, or we didn't know what joy looked like. But in my mind's eye of like what this could be, like this, it felt like a deep well, which is, you know, as a producer, something you look for. Like, is there something worthy of a movie?
Mm.
And when he pitched it and said this very simple idea of we could tell a story where we personify emotions. You know, we like movies that are emotional. What if we personified them? And what if it was about a little girl, but it wasn't about her so much as she used the set? And just those two things lit me up. And that was kind of, I guess that would be like my core memory of it. Along the way, there were a million of them, including seeing Joy walk for the first time, or seeing the first screening where we saw like the dinner scene where I could see the potential of the movie, hearing the score from Michael Giacchino sitting in his
gorgeous office.
Yeah, he's amazing. So all those moments, there's probably three or four of them that felt like just these big impactful beats that told me this was going to be a movie, and I hope you know what I think is a really good movie that I hope everyone else agrees is, you know.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, so good to meet you, and congratulations again. Just, it's a real honor to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Pixar Podcast. I'm Derek Clements. And that was my conversation that you heard with Jonas Rivera, the producer of Inside Out. I'm now going to play you some more of Jonas Rivera and also from Pete Docter. This is a roundtable interview with both of them. And in the coming weeks, be sure to stay tuned to the Pixar Podcast. I'm going to share with you more interviews and behind-the-scenes Pixar stuff that I recorded last week in my trip to Pixar. Next week, we're going to hear from James Ford Murphy, the creator of the new Pixar short Lava. And I have another surprise for you that I recorded inside Pixar last week as well. So thanks again for listening. And now here is my roundtable interview with producer Jonas Rivera and director Pete Docter.
Cookie, you don't want a cookie?
Yeah, there's lots of cookies.
Come on.
Nobody's eating them yet. It's a little early for cookies, I guess.
There you go.
Nice.
No fear.
Good.
We eat a lot of cookies on this show. I mean, Pete is the king of cookies. He won't say, but
who doesn't like cookies?
I mean, it's unbelievable, actually.
Hawaiian cookies?
Any kind of
cookies. Is that a reference?
Yeah, any kind.
There's a cookie shop over in Nimeryville that we'd have to send people to, like, every day, pretty much.
Yeah, I went there once, and the lady said, do you work here in the mall? Because I was there that often. No, actually not.
So how's it going so far? Who'd you guys just see? Did you see Angelique?
Yes.
Is she awesome?
Cool. She's been lighting was a trip on this show because of especially Joy being a light source, you know. She probably told you things like shadows, you know, you can't really do shadows. Mm-hmm. Even the shaping was tricky.
You didn't make it easy on lighting.
No. So you guys see the 56 minutes or whatever yesterday, right? Mm-hmm.
Instantly wanted to see the rest of it.
Okay, good. Well,
cool. We're sorry, we didn't show the whole thing. We're excited to have something else to show you.
Yeah,
feel free to ask
me
questions.
Oh, okay, yeah. What you guys,
did we thoughts? Ask you guys questions?
Sure. No.
I'm Jonas Rivera, I'm the producer.
And I'm Pete Docter, the director.
I was trying to think of a funny name. This is Ed
Frankenheimer.
Okay. Bill Kaputnik.
That's a good name.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how much the movie changed from the initial idea that you had for it, or if it was pretty close to what you imagined it as.
Well, compared to Up, it was like exactly. Because Up, I think we started with floating city and princes and things and weird. And then it became an old man who flies his house to South America. This one, the basic concept was the same. My initial pitch to you guys was... emotions as characters that live inside of a kid, and even I think I wrote like an example of kids gonna raise their hand at school and fear is like, what are you crazy? Don't do that, dude. We'll be embarrassed. And then, you know, so just all the voices that happen in that simple situation. But we didn't have the plot. I guess we also kind of early on knew that we were gonna deal with the sort of growing up story.
I mean, you pitched it as a sort of an observation of your daughter, which then we knew like, okay, that's cool. That's truth and emotional and. And this idea that I sat forward on, which was this, what if we told a story of a little girl, but she's not the main character, she's the setting. And you know, that made us go, whoa, that's cool.
Yeah.
So these big pieces that are still employed in the movie were there, but yeah, to Pete's point, there was a lot of writing and plot, and who's who, and who says what. And
yeah,
what.
And that's where you get, you know, people like Ronnie and Josh and, you know, Meg we worked with and Michael Arndt. We've kind of embarrassing... riches that we have at our disposal here, these amazing people who come forward with idea after idea, knowing that 9/10 of them are going to get tried out and thrown away.
Right. Sort of exhausting.
Yeah.
But yeah, everyone, I mean, the story changed and evolved, although, I mean, we brought in Bill Hader, he helped us write, Amy Poehler came in and wrote with us, and I mean, the story was kind of figured out with Amy, but she just helped with the voices and
how they would phrase things.
So it's the movie's never really done until literally like two Fridays ago when we finished it.
Yeah.
It's kind of live the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
What did your daughter say about the movie?
She hasn't seen the whole thing when it's been done. She saw it along the way and she was kind of like, yeah, good movie, Dad.
Our kids are like totally unimpressed.
Yeah.
They come in here. Up and my kid's like, no, we want to watch Lego. Okay.
They come in here and ride the scooters and eat the candy, and they think that's what we do.
They do think that.
Is she going to see herself in it? Do you think? Is it personal to her?
Well, she...
Maybe not yet.
Probably not. Probably not. I think she'll watch it and kind of see it from... But maybe I hope it'll resonate on some level, and it'll only be years later that she'll kind of go, oh, wow, that's...
How old is she now?
She's now 16.
Oh, 16.
Yeah.
Right.
Still, yeah, once in a while.
16.
Yeah. But I think one of the reasons it triggered kind of a response in me, because she was, I think, like I told you guys yesterday, she was about 11 when we started. I recognized my own rough journey. So, you know, when I saw her kind of getting quiet, I was like, oh no, I know it's coming, because I was there. I had a rough time in junior high myself. And so... in part, it's based on her, but it's also based on personal experience and all of that stuff, too. So there go the loud animators. Hello, animators.
I love it. Yeah. We actually wanted to sit in here so you guys could sit. Like, this is the pod where we sat and waited. We didn't want to throw you guys in a conference room.
Those are all the whiteboards where we put numbers up.
That's our animation footage. Yep. Nobody cares about it, but I do.
So yeah, when was the moment along the creative process of making the film, maybe it was in the beginning, maybe it was recently toward the end, that you were just most excited about letting people see this film?
Mm. That's a good question. It kind of would go in cycles for me. At the beginning, it was like, oh, this is going to be great. And then you start, the honeymoon's over, and you're realizing that this is a lot of work. And then you'd hit these little peaks, and you'd be excited. And then this goes back to... I had this dinner once, it was awesome, with Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson, who's, of course, the great Disney animators, and Joe Grant. And we were talking about ideas and films that were out, and everybody was like, yeah, there's this, but it's lousy, and there's this, but it's lousy. And Ollie goes, aren't there any good ideas out there? And Joe laughed, and he said, they're all great ideas till you have to tell it to somebody else, which is totally true. Like that's, and so I would be like, this is great, and then we'd show it, and you're like, oh, actually, it doesn't really. In my mind, it was great, but then you go back to work, and now I'm getting excited again, because I feel like, I have no idea how people will respond, but I'm proud of the movie.
But there were micro moments along the way, like for me, where...
There's Catherine Serafian.
Catherine.
Hi.
She produced Brave. We love Catherine.
Hey.
Bye, Catherine. Where, like, for example, Ronnie Del Carmen, who you'll meet, I remember, because we lived with it so long, and just this great idea, and starting to, small group of five of us kind of kicking things around, and Ronnie boarded this little bit with a little girl walking to school.
Oh, yeah.
And cool. He just illustrated, it's just beautiful. She's walking to school, and she's happy, and she's, like, saying hi to everybody, and then she got to school, and something happened, I don't even remember. Some kid was mean to her, her friend didn't sit with her, and then she walked home from school completely sad. And there was something in the way he boarded it and drew it that I was, for the first time, like, oh, I see it. It's I see it as a movie.
Yeah.
Now, like, I can't wait. Like, let's show it to everybody. And you're like, no, let's do more and change it. But so there's a million of those moments, and like maybe seeing the dinner scene that you saw for the first time when you see it through the woods or through the weeds, and some of the things that... with joy, and I don't know, where you see the potential beyond just the idea, and that's so at every level. Like, you see it in story, you see it in the art department, you see it in technical, you see it in animation, and that's almost like you come to work at least once a week, something like that happens, and gives you fuel, you know, to keep going.
That's how you do it for 5 years.
That's how you do it for 5 years.
Seeing cool stuff from people.
Right. Mm.
So in Monsters U, Corey Ray kind of talked about that there was this scene where they wanted to incorporate Sully and Mike's parents.
When
they were kids, but eventually it came down to it was slowing down the story too much. There's no way to make it work without spending way too much time. Was there any moment like that or a scene that you really wanted but had to cut out based on either time or it was taking too long to develop?
There's one that I loved. You saw that, right? The music.
Oh,
one.
Yeah.
So we boarded a whole thing based on the idea that music needs to be understood in some part of the brain. Like, if you watch your dog when you're playing music, clearly the dog's just hearing, like, noise, right? But for us, it means something. So there's probably some center of the mind
that's funny.
that interprets music, and joy and sadness go through that. And as joy is talking to sadness, you know, her voice becomes like a violin or something, or, like, they become music themselves, and it was really cool. And then shapes would form, like, as they would speak, it would form these cool shapes and things. So just from an animation standpoint, I was super excited about that. But it ended up being too similar, pretty obviously, to Abstract Thought,
right?
Which was probably more like basic So we cut that out. But there were other cool ideas. Like we thought, well, they should head down the Boulevard of Broken Dreams.
Right.
The Secrets Vault.
The Secrets Vault.
Where all secrets that Riley knew about were locked up. Supposed to get out of there.
They got out to be dangerous.
Yeah.
So. And then how far did that idea get before it was?
That one we boarded too.
What about the hobo?
A lot of these. The imaginary friends.
Well, that sort of evolved.
I guess. It did.
But that was this funny idea. It was her drawings. It was Riley's drawings.
Mrs. Scribbles.
Like Mrs. Scribbles. And they're like, if you draw like the sun in the corner of your thing with the thing, and it would float around and it would be totally fully animated Pixar style, but a kid's drawing. Joy, you know.
We were so excited about that too.
We thought that was
bright. But you know,
it made no sense.
The story leads you at some point.
Yeah.
Do you have a daughter?
I have two daughters, yeah.
Teenager?
Mine 9 and 6, and I have a 3-year-old son. So, yeah, and Ronnie Del Carmen has his kids are out of college. And so the three of us would spend a lot of time comparing notes and looking through the lens of like a parent and, you know.
You can borrow mine anytime.
Oh my God. I would come into work. I learned a lot because I would come into work like, guys, I'm exhausted. Oh, the girls had nightmares all night. I couldn't sleep. And they'd say, what I wouldn't give for that. I'm like, what?
Relish those days.
Yeah, tell me a lot about it. I think the theme of the film is like, that's, you know, growing up and there's nothing you can do about that and so forth. And so I think that's what Joy's
kind of. I'm dragging mine to the movies. I'm telling you. Like,
how old? She
11.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
New York.
My niece is 11, and I've always I was wondering when I was watching this yesterday, it feels like she's always like buried in some kind of phone or tablet or something. Uh-huh. And I noticed you guys seem to like purposefully not use a lot of technology to tell the story.
It's interesting.
Was that on purpose or is it
somebody
just
else said that too? Maybe it's just because we're Luddites. I mean, she does talk to her friend and on Skype, or whatever we invented the Skype surrogate.
Yeah.
But I think, my kids, when they were up until recently, didn't have phones. So maybe that's, I guess a lot of it is like, these sort of scenes are really boring, you know, just sitting watching somebody type or whatever. So we tried to make it more active.
I think it is interesting. I think we're parents on the border of that generation, right? Wow. Like, you know,
yep.
I mean, when I was in, I didn't have, my first no email was here at Pixar.
Yeah.
20 years ago. I had him. Yep. And so our kids are a little slow to the point. I think kids, how old's your niece?
She's 11.
Yeah, 11. Probably Ellie 16. So right on that border now, every kid is going to have it. But it's also, I don't know, it wasn't intentionally either way, other than just what the story needed. But maybe it's a little bit how we see the world or want to see the world. Like, I'm so sick of everyone looking at their.
And the scene that when she's like Skyping or something, mm-hmm. I love it because that's the play they stand for my daughter. Like,
right.
Like, you want to invite someone home? I'm like, no, I'm already, like, hanging out with all my friends in my room. I'm like,
Where?
Yeah. Terrified
in the world. And then I start yelling or something. Like, Mom, wait, I'm with her. I'm like,
I'm with her.
Can you let me know when you're talking to someone so I behave?
That's right. You could, your friends will hear you.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that speaks to a lot of this conversation, to sort of the guts of the movie for us and why it was easy to get behind it and, you know, spend so much time on it, is that it's like these are emotions, and we thought that was really fun to personify and make sort of our version of the Seven Dwarfs, but it was easy for us to hook into it because we drew the analogy like, well, they're like her parents. Mm-hmm. They're this team of advisors that she has, and like a parent or an aunt or an uncle, like, you do your best to guide, you know, but you can't control, even when you think you can, like Joy. And
kids still may or may not listen to you.
They may or may not listen to you, and so that's just interesting and truth.
Yeah, and it's true of emotions, too, and that's kind of the way we broke it down, is like, you don't choose to feel angry, you just do, right? It's, that's a feeling that comes to you, but then you choose how you're going to deal with it. You could hit somebody, or you could mask it, or you could, you know, any number of things, so that's kind of the way the rules we established for this film as well.
So one of my favorite movies is Dumbo. I love the Disney animated classics. Yeah. Pete, I know how much you love it. I listened to your director's commentary for that.
Oh, cool.
And I've heard you mention how those films inspired Inside Out in several ways. Can you talk a little bit about how they serve as an inspiration for Inside Out?
Yeah, well, and of course, you know, as I was talking about Joe a minute ago, was a huge inspiration. Just like mind-blowing to me to, like, this is the guy who did that.
Right.
And I grew up on this film, and now I get to hear firsthand, like, experiences. And the thing that struck me the most, because I always imagined that as sort of a mythical magic time where everybody was a genius and everything, and Joe's like, it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same now. Wait, really? We're just dumb idiots finding our way through this by trial and error. He's like, yep, same thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there is a real magic to those films and a simplicity to them that we're, I don't think we've really achieved, you know? The stories are so basic and rudimentary and so primal, like that one especially, the sort of mother love is really strong. And so the whole story could, you know, you could really get lost in a complexity of that story of all the different elements and what's happening, but they strip it down so basic so that each sequence they can just have fun with.
It's really sophisticated.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
I know, and the speed at which they worked back then, we were just talking about these things taking 5 years. Sometimes they would, as you know. Like I think Peter Pan was in and out of development for like 12 years or something before it finally came out. But Dumbo came along and was released within three, I think.
Right.
From when Walt first gave the little book to Joe. So.
But I don't know. There's a charm and a grace to those films that we look to. They're just so mysterious. I mean, here you've got this lab of artists and technical artists here at Pixar. They can figure out to do anything you want to do and get it to the screen. And really good brain trust story writers, directors, artists. We sit and we watch Dumbo on film, and it's sort of like this Da Vinci Code of like, how did they do that? How does it work? It's so good.
Yeah.
So we look at those films a lot. Not a day goes by that we're not talking about those or breaking those down and thinking about it. And that's kind of the feeling we're after with these films. I'm not saying these films are there, because I think you're right. Like we've not achieved that, but I don't know. We hope to flirt with it, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that your films, Pete, have to do with Dumbo, that you just kind of mentioned, like your films seem to inhabit two worlds of ultra realistic and also ultra kind of like silly or ultra imaginative, you know? Uh-huh. And I think Dumbo, the way you were describing Dumbo, the core mother love, but also you can just have all these crazy gags and the dreams and stuff.
Yeah.
But could you talk about kind of inhabiting that world? I mean, the Up is an example. Like, it's so realistic. It's so, even more than other Pixar films, but it's also like there's dogs that fly airplanes and and Inside Out is more of that thing of the dual citizenship of the silly and the realistic.
Yeah, and that's something I learn over and over, like with Monsters, with Up. You know, the further you just go off into like this would just be fun, and I don't really have a good reason for it, but it's awesome.
Yeah.
The further you go that way, the less the audience connects.
Yeah.
So it's almost like, as you create it, it's so counterintuitive because it just seems cool. This is going to be so cool. This is going to be cool. And then you get there and you realize, oh, there's nothing for anybody to hold on to in terms of truth. So, like you just said, you got to, every time we end up stripping back to going, okay, what is this really about that is about me? Cool. So it might be about monsters or flying dogs or whatever, but I have to recognize myself somehow and the problems that I'm experiencing in my own life. And then you can, once you have that, you can get to silly, fun stuff.
Yeah.
But it always has to have a real life truth.
As a matter of fact, you have that, you can go even further than you think. I mean, flying dogs, I thought, is a pretty good example. It goes pretty far.
Yeah.
But you know, there's enough, hopefully, emotional core to the movie that the audience lets you go there.
Yeah.
They let you know if they don't.
Yeah.
You
know. Boo.
Yeah, boo.
They usually don't go boo, but they do. Like we've had a couple test screenings.
But here
the way
they, they don't boo, but you know,
they tell you.
You know?
Usually the audience tells you just by like, you know, they're restless.
Yeah.
You can tell they're just not engaged and connected
right.
to it. So, yeah.
And there's a part of the movie which you also show the brain world of the parents. Will you be showing that a little bit more? It would speed that one.
Maybe.
Because it was very.
I get to go back there in the last act.
How long
she was engaged, see?
Yeah.
How long is it?
Yeah.
With credits, I think it's like 92.
Yeah.
92.
Yeah.
Like 87.
I think it's 87 with the body of the film, yeah.
So you're talking about the emotional core. So obviously, this is a film about emotions. But what do you see as being like the real emotional core there?
Well, I hesitate to get too deep into it because you haven't seen the whole thing. I don't want to give anything away. But I think it has a lot to do with how emotions work in the most important things in our lives, and that's human relationships. And a real turning point in the film was at a point where I was like, this is not working, I'm gonna get fired. We've worked for 2.5 years on this and I'm nowhere. And then I sort of had this epiphany that the people that I feel the closest attachment to are, yeah, I've had good times with them, but there are people that I've been pissed off at or sad with, that we've suffered loss together, that we've been scared, I've been scared for them. Like, the emotions in our lives are really the things that bring us together and connect us, and that's what the film speaks to.
So speaking of some of the emotions and early concept art that we saw, Ricky Nierva's work had the emotions almost looking like some of the Dream production workers or the Forgetters. So how did they eventually evolve into who they are today?
Well, at the beginning, what we did was to just write up like a character description, almost the way you describe a person. And I would say, you know, Fear is a guy who feels very confident until the smallest thing makes him freak out like crazy. Anything I could think of that was not physical, just more kind of a psychological profile. And then we had a bunch of different artists, Ricky, Ralph, we had folks like Richard Thompson, who does cul-de-sac. We had, who else do we have?
Well, Albert Lozano.
Yeah.
Our character, he ended up being our character art director, right. Chris Sasaki.
Right. So they all came back with like thousands of drawings, and we literally, like, there was no square inch of wall space left in the art room.
It wouldn't just be design, it'd be like, you know, even through stories, like, based on your character profiles, like Andy Griffith, you know, the Mayberry. Don Knotts from the Andy Griffith show, or some stills from 12 Angry Men for anger, and just started to, like, who are these people?
Real life actors.
Joy would have, like, Bugs Bunny, you know, meets Amelie or something, like just starting to figure out who they might be and then what they look like.
Yeah, it's really cool talking to Ricky the way he approaches character design, because I feel like it's really close to caricature. When you watch him do a caricature, and he and Teddy Newton are just like savants at this, they don't look at you and draw you. That's like illustration. He'll kind of study you, and then he gets a mental image and he draws from that feeling that he has. And I think character design is kind of the same way, where he's trying to internalize it, come up with like a strong concept of who it is, and then it comes out somehow magically.
Remember he drew you once? He did a 3-second eyes closed caricature of you.
Yeah, he literally like closed his eyes and went like this.
And it's the funniest drawing.
Like, oh my gosh, it's me. Crazy good.
So were you able to roll up your sleeves and animate on the film at all?
No, I got scared. Because they rewrote the software between Up and Now. And everybody was talking about how different it was, and I was thinking, it's going to take me like a month just to learn the software, and I barely have time to think between the writing and the recording and all the other stuff. So
that was a good tradition. I wish we could have kept
that. Yeah, kind of a bummer.
How did you come up with the girl's name, Ronnie?
I think Ronnie named her.
Ronnie, I think so. And then we, this is just to cement it, we were at the... we went over to the Walt Disney Family Museum and asked if we could have like a couple of 2-day offsites over there, and they let us use their conference room. And we were in there for a couple of days just toiling over the scripts and writing and whiteboards. And we walked out of their back room, by the way, it looks out over the Golden Gate Bridge, and we walked out on the back sort of steps, and we looked up and we're on Riley Lane. So we're like, I guess that's sticking.
Yeah.
It's a sign.
Yeah.
It's a sign, literally.
What inspired the design of the brain workers? I thought of them as like placebos almost.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't figure out.
They were single cell.
Yeah, like amoebas or single cell organisms, pretty much. I mean, I think we said yesterday, we tried not to do the brain or the mind, but there were little influences here and there, even like the way the shelves of memories are stacked, they're kind of like the folds of the brain, and some of the textures here and there. But we tried to keep it all very subtle.
But those guys are fun. I mean, there's a big place, and there's a lot of locations and trains and probably jobs. And so, what was your rules? So anything that was sort of a task would be a character. Like forgetting.
So in real life, it's an electrochemical process, and in our world, it's a person. It's a character who does that.
So like putting on a dream would be a director that would drive that.
Right.
Can we take for one last question?
Okay.
Yesterday you mentioned that you did a lot of research about emotions, how the brain works, yeah. And I wonder what do you find most surprising about this research?
I think the most surprising thing, which on one level is kind of obvious, but there are all these emotions that are at work, and the way the whole thing is designed, it's almost invisible to you. So you think of yourself as basically what's in the frontal lobe. If I'm the guy who decides, should I have a cookie or not? No, I'm going to wait until lunch. But there's a whole separate system which is causing you to act and speak and behave in certain ways, which is entirely invisible to you, below your conscious threshold. And I think that basic concept of people, the complexity of the way people act, and it really caused me to rethink the way I talk to people and how I interact with people, and it was pretty life-changing.
Like in what sense? Can you give us a specific example?
Well, I mean, this is not too deep, but you know, somebody will say something or act in a certain way, and I'd be like, "Hey, that pisses me off," and then I'd think more, and I would understand on a deeper level. They're not even conscious of it, but they're scared, and that's why they said this to me. And so that instead of being mad at them, I can sympathize with them and empathize with them and understand what they're going through. So instead of being combative, suddenly I'm on board with them just by thinking kind of through a deep, to a deeper level.
Emotional intelligence.
He used to punch my face like 4 times a day. Now it almost never happens.
See, this movie's been good.
All right.
Thanks, you guys. Thanks for coming.
Have a good time.
We appreciate it.
Okay, Squirt here will now give you a rundown of proper exiting technique.
Mom, it's just my ball.
Don't let it happen again.
Yes, well, I'll try to be less careless.
It's got this kind of burning, melty, it's not really a smoky taste. It's a certain, it's kind of like a, it's kind of like this ba-boom, zap kind of taste. Don't you think? What would you call that flavor?
Lightning?
Don't look at the light!
I can't help it. It's so beautiful.
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you.
Gone! It's all gone. All of it's gone. Bye-bye. Woo, see ya.
Thank you for listening to the Pixar Podcast.